How's everybody doing?
Awesome.
You guys doing good? Good. Great to be here doing the first remote show ever for the Mark Haney Show live. And who better to share the mic with me than Dale Carlson? He's the founder of Sleep Train. I have a list of your accomplishments, 312 stores. Over, I don't know how much the revenue is, hundreds and hundreds of millions in revenue. You created an employee stock ownership plan, and as you exited your company, you distributed over $100 million to your partners, your employees, and you created a culture that I think is second to none. And one of my mantras is that nobody builds a truly great company alone. And I'm here with Dale Carlson to see if he agrees with that and to help expand upon the people part of the business. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, Mark. I mean, there's no way I didn't build that company. My employees and my coworkers, we built the company. So it takes everybody to make something successful.
So a lot of people are talking about building a great culture, and the Sleep Train was known for that. How would you describe the culture at the Sleep Train?
Where do we go with that? The culture at Sleep Train, we wanted to build a culture that was real, that meant that we cared about, you know, the philosophy was my dad. Well, I'll start with my dad's quote.
Okay.
Because that really what set the tone for me. My dad, when I started, first of all, those of you who've heard my story know my dad didn't agree with me starting this company. He thought it was stupid. Why? How could you possibly make money selling mattresses? I did. It was a good deal. but, you know, he told me after he got over my decision to do this that, you know, if you want to be successful, surround yourself with great people, treat them well, and make everybody successful. So to do that, if you're going to surround yourself with great people, you got to build a culture they want to be part of. It has to be a culture that's about them succeeding as well as you succeeding. It's a culture about the community around you succeeding so that you know that you're helping and making an impact in the world besides just making the bottom line dollar. It's about a culture that cares about the customer and what their needs are. So we created a culture that was focused on all three. That it was about our customers, it was about our employees, and it was about our community. And with that, we could succeed.
Well, it's interesting. I've always thought of culture as the composite of the team's attitudes, values, and their actions. So on the values piece, your dad, he knew you needed to surround yourself with great people. I mean, where did your early values come from?
Well, my values, my parents, grandparents, and family helped create my values from the early days, early age on up. And, you know, my values were, you know, really based on what they had taught me. And that was the number one rule, golden rule, do unto others as you'd have done unto you, right? And along with that, you know, my faith also helped direct me to where my values were as well. And then as I grew and as I became older and as I became married, got married, my wife helped to fine-tune my rough spots of my values and make sure that I was always grounded. My children, then you have children, they kind of teach you a little bit too, because you learn that if I want them to be the person I want them to be, I have to demonstrate that myself. So,
well, it sounds like you've learned some of your values through corrective times. Maybe it was your wife, maybe it was your children, maybe it was your dad. Were there any things that happened to you in your younger years that sort of maybe were on the negative side that shaped you and they became great lessons to build that foundation for values?
That's a good question.
No mistakes as a kid?
Oh, no. I tell my wife, no, I was a perfect child. She just doesn't believe it. As a kid, that's a good question. As a kid, well, I'll tell one. My parents got divorced. I had a stepfather who wasn't, well, we'll just bypass that. Anyway, he had bought a Shetland pony horse to eat the grass next to our house, and as for me to ride. But it was really for him to do that. So I had this responsibility of the horse, and he wanted to teach me responsibility, take care of the horse, feed the horse, do all of that. But I wasn't to ride it out in the hills because that was dangerous, and I was supposed to stay in the local area on that. Well, my buddies were all going out for a ride, And I decided, well, I'm going for a ride, and I wasn't supposed to. And sure enough, as things will happen, we're out there, we're galloping through, and my stupid little stubborn horse sees a puddle and stops, and I go flying off, and it takes off. Well, you know, if I go home without that horse, it's not going to be good. You know, but I did. We rounded up the horse. We brought it back in. I got home, shared with my mom my mistake. She said, okay, we can't tell him, but you will never do that again. So a lesson of responsibility that was wrong. I was told not to do it, and I still did it, and there's a consequence of doing something that's wrong. So that was an early age thing.
Moral of the story. So you think about that, and these things that shape us as young people, they really help us to build our teams and grow. So as we talk about you founding the Sleep Train, I know you started with one store, it didn't go so well, and somehow you decided to turn it into two stores. What happened, and did you do that all yourself, or were there teammates involved in some of your earlier successes and failures?
Well, when I started, it was just myself doing everything. I had a couple fraternity brothers that would fill in when I wasn't there. And we were going along, and once again, my dad was not in favor of this, so I was about 8 months into it, and it was going under. I mean, we were not making enough money to make this work, and I needed to decide what to do, and so that's when we decided to expand to the second store, because I figured I'd go broke twice as fast and get it over with, or I'd make it work, which is what you do as an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
How about you? Have you?
Yes. Grow. I'm pretty much. I think as entrepreneurs, we have a lot of entrepreneurs in the audience, and we have some people with ideas. And I think the first step for me was showing up. You know, first thing is just getting that courage to go for it. And I'm one of those people that sort of go all in, maybe even too early. And it sounds like you were cut from that same cloth.
Yeah. It was. You know, My old boss used to say I was like a dog with a sock. If I couldn't get something this way, I pulled it this way. If I couldn't get it that way, you know, you just keep dragging that thing until I can make it work, which is what we did. So I opened the second store, and that's when I started building the team. You know, I had a fraternity brother that had joined me that was pretty good on the computer. And computer, this is 1985, folks, so this is not when computers were actually there. But he was actually really smart on what he was doing. So he started doing programming for me, and we actually started over the next several years, built our own POS system, point of sale system, and had it all internally. We had that until we end. We progress and progress, but bringing that gentleman on board as being a partner to me, and then we grew the company together in many ways. We were kind of opposite, you know, because you want to fill your void of what you're not good at. And he was a good spot to fill that void for me.
Well, it's one of the things I see with a lot of entrepreneurs, especially early stage, there's a high percentage of people that fail in those early years, and then very few unleash their full potential. Was there a turning point for Sleep Training for you where you really began to bloom and unleash your full potential, and were the people a part of that or a key in that?
Well, I'd like to say the turning point was actually when I sold, but no. The turning point for me was really when I realized, and it took me a while to get there, how important delegation is, and delegation by completely giving it to the other person, not giving it to the other person and then expecting them to do it your way. When I finally realized the power of letting someone else take on a project and do it their way, even though it's not your way, it might be better. And time again, I would see that happen where, wow, they're far better at that than I am. And that's when I learned that really, to me, and this is my advice to all founders, your job's to put yourself out of a job by finding someone better in each role to do it better than you. That's how you really succeed. If you can find your holes and where you're not good at and make sure that everybody's there and be honest with yourself, that's the key thing, the honesty. Because we all think we're great at everything. But reality is we don't. We suck at most things. There's only a few things we're very good at. So to be able to understand that is that was really a turning point for the company, for me and for the company, is understanding, giving it up to someone else and letting them run with it.
I was lucky in building my companies that I didn't think I was good at anything. So that was very helpful. Bringing on other people was almost a necessity, and I knew it. But thinking about for your situation, you're good at everything.
No, I'm not.
Well, you know, there's people that are just kind of generally good at everything, and people get stretched out when that happens. So when you see people today that are getting too stretched out, right? They're trying to wear every hat. I mean, what's the answer? Go hire somebody, bring in a business partner, an equity partner. How do you go about those steps in an early stage company where you need to put people in your life that are better at things than you? How do you do it?
That's a good question. I mean, for me, it took me a slow process because we were bootstrapped from the day one and didn't have funding. In retrospect, and mind you, really back in that, I didn't have the experience of what you all have here of understanding what entrepreneurship is and growth and the community that Mark's building in our region and what this center is. I didn't have access to that. So I didn't understand how I could bring on a partner or how that might work, pros and cons of it. I just knew that I had no money and we had to make it work. But it is, so you slowly do it. The thing is doing something. I think that was the key, is that as you could, you do it. Okay, I need to replace this, I need to replace that, I need to replace that. And as you grow, and you know, I'll ask you on this, but one of the things that I experienced, and I'm jumping ahead, early stage is here of building that, but you could have a great person in a role that can't scale to the next size of the company. And having to make that change is hard, and making that change in a timely manner is hard. Pete, we're all good at certain things, and we're all good at certain levels, but somebody, you know, an accounting person you have in your department that's great when you're, you know, from zero to, you know, $1 million in revenue, can't comprehend what to do when you're making $10 or $100 million in revenue. They don't have that skill set in place. So you need to be able to constantly improve the talent if your team is not scalable.
One of the things that we did, I built some security companies and had a nice exit several years ago, so he's referencing some of my background for those of you that don't know me. But one of the things that we did, especially in those early stages, we decided that there's no problem more sales won't fix, because every time we, you know, anytime that things, one of the wheels comes off, we just have to go sell some more stuff, right? And that we'll be able to put another wheel back on. So that's how we sort of dealt with the obstacles as you go along in building a company. But thinking about this allocation of resources, right? Where to put your bandwidth, where to hire first? Is it more important to have great people on the numbers, more important to have great people on the sales and marketing, or more important to focus on that product and perfecting the product? You know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier.
We had Ernesto Cirelli come in from the Cirelli Institute here at the center to do a presentation. And he talked about, you know, the three categories he believes are most important are product, marketing. And marketing is not just marketing and sales, but it's the market as well. And then your financial strength. So you take all three of those, and if you're not, you know, if you really kind of look at them all, you need them all. And what's more important? They're all kind of equally important, or they bring you down in one way or another.
In the sleep train, so if we look at your P&L or your budget, right? So how, if we were to break it down, how much did you have going to admin and support versus sales and marketing, and how did you break down? How did you guys break it down?
I haven't looked at those in a long time. You know, I was very fortunate that I had surrounded myself with some great people. So we had pretty much an equal basis on that, because we believed that all those areas, in the end, you know, with all those areas were important, where we had, you know, we had our executive leadership team was built of solid people in each of their categories. So really kind of focusing on all of them. Marketing, and they all had a seat at the table. You know, I ran what I call, you know, a consensus leadership model, basically, where I believe that everybody at the table has the same vote. They all knew I had the extra vote if I wanted it. But quite frankly, there are only two or three that I can say, you know, where I said that.
How many people were at the table? Let's walk
13.
Through this. You had 13 people at this table, and what kind of decisions got made at the table?
Pretty much all major decisions were made at the table. And what I would say from a culture, the fact that we had everybody at the table made it so that everybody, every department felt they were part of the company. And there were no stepchildren in the company because everybody was at the table. And what it did was when we had an issue, something would come up, something that might be a marketing issue. It's a marketing issue and we're talking about it and everything. It was amazing the input that our legal department might have or our HR department might have that are not, it wasn't legal comments, it was marketing comments from their just being outside of the bucket, being able to put insight into it. So we learned, and you know, operations issues, you have operations issues and all of a sudden you've got all these other departments saying, oh, you know, we can help you by doing this. If we did this, that would help you on your operations. So having everybody at the table was what helped build our culture of really everybody counting in our company.
Somebody has said to me in the past somewhere that it sounds like management by committee in some way, that maybe that's not necessarily the way to move the company the fastest is to manage by this committee. How did you deal with the speed of needing to get things done?
Well, let me make sure that's clear. We didn't have a committee where this is a once a month and we're talking top-level decisions long-term, not daily decisions. The marketing department did what they needed to do. The accounting department did what they did. The legal department did. The HR, they did all the
Fully empowered at the store.
Yeah, you do what you need to do, and you've got the budget. Here's your budget. Keep within your budget. Keep within the law, and it's yours. But it's when we're making big strategic moves and strategic changes or things like that that we have the full power of everybody, or an issue that comes up during the day-to-day that says, okay, I need some more insight on how to handle this.
What about transparency? It's common today for CEOs to be explaining everything to their teammates, to their employees. Give them the financials. Give them all the data. It's helpful. Are you a person that says there's some things that should be kept in management hands in terms of information, or should everything be shared with the employees?
I'm in between.
Okay.
I'm in between because I think too much information without enough background is dangerous. And so I think you have to get the information that's vital for success of the team, but not overload them with stuff that doesn't make sense or you don't know how to process it because there's elements that it would take too much energy and too much information to get you there. So we shared our top line financials. They knew where we were. They knew what our EBITDA was. They knew our earnings. They knew where we're at here and where our buckets were. But it was not, and especially and that really started when we did the ESOP. Then we became more transparent at that stage. And we found it very valuable if everybody was on the same page. Our saying was we want everybody pointed north. As long as we got everybody pointed north and everybody wins if we win. And that's the culture that we wanted. It was a culture of everybody wins at the same time. And it's not individuals winning. And then it's also a culture of accountability.
And if I think about your story, there was the early stages and then the ESOP was a turning point of some sort in terms of building the culture. Am I right?
Absolutely.
How did that, tell me about that.
Well, first of all, for those that don't know an ESOP, it's an employee stock ownership plan. It's where employees receive shares in the company, not by paying for them, but by simply working for the company. By the hours they put in at the company, they would earn so many shares. For that year, and it'd grow. So I had heard about this and thought, because our culture, once I'm back to culture, had been one of an ownership mentality from the beginning. Because I was out with everybody. I talked with the district managers, with the sales managers, to the warehouse workers, to everybody, hearing what was working, what wasn't working. We had annual retreats where we would sit there, get out of the woods, and look back at the trees and say, what's working, what's not working. So understanding that culture is there, and everybody feeling they had input then. You know, and we all want to feel that. We want to feel that we have input, that we value. We're valued and that we can actually add something. So we had that culture already. And then I was looking at it and I came across a conference on ESOPs. And I learned about that. I go, wow, that's fantastic. And how better to fulfill my dad's quote of I'd already surrounded myself with great people. I already took really good care of them. But how do I make everybody truly successful? And that's in sharing with what the success of the company was. And so my wife and I I'm married to a great woman who doesn't care about money. She doesn't care about anything but people and doing the right thing. And, you know, she's saying, why do we need all this? There are others that, you know, can benefit. And so we did the ESOP and gave 25% of the company to the employees. That was a fundamental change. Within the 4 years, we did the ESOP finally in 2010, against my financial planners, everybody's advice, because this was at the low of valuation. The company was at a low valuation. They said, why would you give away 25% of your company at a low valuation? Why don't you wait till you build it back up? And then, because we'd gone through the recession on that. And I said, because I want all of them to benefit from this growth. In the 4 years, the value of our company went 800% up. 800%, because they were owners. We transferred $117 million to our employees when we sold.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible. Well, you built, part of your culture was in the greater good. Beyond building Sleep Train, you did things within Sleep Train to help the greater good. Where did that come from? And maybe you can describe the Ticket to Dream and the other things that you did at Sleep Train to really help the greater good.
Sure. Well, that comes from my values once again. I was raised, you got to give back. You know, my dad and uncle were both Rotarians. They did all sorts of stuff that way. My grandmother was constantly doing philanthropy and things of that nature. So I was raised to give back. So when I started, I looked and said, how can I give back? I don't have any money. I have no money. What can I do? What do I have? What are the resources I have? Well, what did I have? I had mattresses. And I could buy them cheaper than anyone else. Who needs mattresses? Well, I had done a group project here at Sac State at a group home in Sacramento and understood what at-risk kids were going through in our community. And they were living in these homes, but their mattresses were not good. They were sleeping and in different houses, too. They were sleeping in beds that are what we call the banana bed. You know, it goes like this. Well, your back's developing as a young child. That's the worst thing to do, is sleep on a bed like that. And plus, I'm a big believer in education. How are they possibly gonna learn the best they can if they're not sleeping well and coming in tired? So we started our Mattress for Kids program, which was we would give mattresses to at-risk kids in the community. I went to my leveraging partnerships, as you're really good at and you know well. I went to my vendors and said, hey, I need help. I want to help kids. Don't you want to help kids? Don't you want to help kids? Who's gonna say no? Everybody wants to help kids, right? So I said, so here's what I want to do. I want you to sell me 10 mattresses at cost, labor and material, no profit for you. And then I want you to give me 10 on top of that. Will you do that? It's just do it for every store I have. I had one store at the time. Sure, we'll do that. They didn't know we'd have 312 when we ended. But so we gave away thousands of beds of the year at the end of the time. But that's how I got started in it. That was the way. And then when we bought back our company that we had sold in the Northwest, they had just done a collection item for foster kids. Now, part of my values was that you do work in the community. You do your charity work because it's the right thing to do. You don't talk about it. You don't get glory from that. You simply do it because it's the right thing. So I had never publicized our Mattress for Kids program. We had never done anything to say, this is what we do. We just didn't take credit for it. We just did it. I'd been on enough boards at this time, as you know, you've been on boards, to realize the cause needed the exposure. I didn't need the exposure, but foster kids needed to, people needed to understand what the plight of a foster youth was. So we brought the stores back in the Northwest, they had done a collection item for foster kids and brought the public in and invited them to help. When that happened, I looked and said, okay, I can buy that. I'm good with that. But one value line that I drew in the sand was we cannot cross over to say, you know, we buy a bed, save a kid. I didn't want any of our advertising, our sale advertising, mixed with our charity advertising. So we said that we spent 10% of our ad budget, which, by the way, was a lot, as you might have known if you ever lived and heard our ads, but we spent 10% of our ad budget on the foster kid program only to grow that. What it did, though, culturally, was it not only brought customers in saying, I want to do business with you, but our retention from our employees went up because they felt they were working for a company that cared. They got to experience when, you know, the mom and three kids came in the car that they could barely get there in with a bag full of pajamas, they felt touched. They understood that people cared, and they knew that we were making a difference. When they went out and delivered these to the kids, and they saw the joy when a young boy gets a pair of new shoes that he can now run on the playground with and really actually have fun and not be made fun of, they saw the difference. And so the culture grew to be part of, that was part of our cultural glue, was the fact that our company was about greater than ourselves. It was about selling mattresses, which, by the way, wasn't about selling a mattress. It was improving someone's sleep. Understanding what you're selling and what it does for someone is a lot easier sell than just selling something. So we had a culture of understanding that what we sold was a better night's sleep. And we helped our community in the process.
Well, we fast forward to today, to your, I guess it would be the next career of Dale Carlson. We're here at Sac State University, your alma mater, and you have contributed to this tremendous facility here in a very generous and inspirational way to help entrepreneurs and to sort of give back. And when you see an entrepreneur succeed, I mean, how does that make you feel when you see somebody succeed as they're attempting this this very scary, risky thing we love that is entrepreneurship?
Oh, I mean, you know it. You're the king of driving people to do the right thing here and do this. But the joy of working with entrepreneurs is, to me, fascinating. One, it's fascinating what people come up with, you know, to build, design, or service, or whatever. It's just fascinating to me. So I enjoy that intellectual part of just thinking through the process. Wow, that's really cool. Why didn't I think of it? You know, but I also, just watching the success, watching students go from here to here to here is such a reward to watch how that works and what it does.
And thinking about that personal feeling, I know that that's a big part of that. But it's bigger than that. What is happening here in Sacramento at Sac State in entrepreneurship, it's bigger than any one of us feeling good inside. What do you see in terms of the culture here in Sacramento and what your vision for the future of innovation and entrepreneurship in our region?
Well, that's one of the great things we have. Sacramento, our region here, is very unique. And everybody that lives here, has lived here any length of time, understands that. We are not like any other community I've seen because we are a collaborative community. We have people that will partner, reach out, help me, let me help you, let me help that. A lot of people will say we're a Midwest culture in a big city and on the West Coast. But we have this culture of caring and giving back. You see, in the philanthropy world, the community gives a ton back to charity here. And in the entrepreneurial world, that's what, you know, the center here and your help and everybody pulling this together, we wanted to pull the region together to say, let's all work together to create more opportunities, more entrepreneurs, and more success and more impact. Change the world with some of the social things that we can change, some of the direction we can go, where we go. We just had our board of directors meeting here, and we were talking about the buckets that are out there. So the four buckets that I see of entrepreneur, everybody thinks of an entrepreneur. Most people think of an entrepreneur just as the startup guy, right? That's what, when someone says entrepreneur, most people think that. But really, there's a small business entrepreneur, right? That's me. That's what I was. I didn't create anything. I didn't have no technology. I didn't have anything. I just knew a better way to sell mattresses and how to service the customer better and how to do that better. So the mom and pop store that opens up down the street, that's an entrepreneur. They're risking their life savings to open that store, right? That's what you did when you started,
right? You betcha.
And so you've got that customer base and that entrepreneur. Then you've got on the other side, you have the social entrepreneur. Someone that wants to make an impact in the world. Their ROI is not about the bottom line dollar. It's about what impact has changed. Now, here in Sacramento, we have a huge opportunity in Sacramento to change the way government runs. We need innovation in government beyond anything else. And what better place than in the capital of California to be innovative in how government processes things, how government does different aspects of things. So you've got impact you can do for social good and for government good and for, you know, the public world that needs to be fixed as well. Then you've got large corporations. You know, we talked, you know, IBM, for example, in 1990-something, they decided they weren't just going to be a chip manufacturer. They wanted to go into making computers. So they created a whole new company to create their computers. So big corporations still have to be entrepreneurial, because when you only know one thing, you've got to start a whole new business. It's a whole new line that they had to do. And then, of course, you've got the startups. The startup, now for the startup, it has to be a startup and scalable, right? And that's what you preach.
Well, it's interesting. You brought up those four buckets, and I agree with that. And I think there's another group that I think we're addressing here at Sac State as well. All the people out there that have thought about building a business someday. I had an idea to do something and I didn't know where to start. It's that, just that idea, and what do you do with a simple idea? And there are so many people, most of society, if you're an adult, if you're over 18 years old, you probably thought, wow, that's a good idea. I wonder if I could turn that into a business. And I think that whole group of people, it's probably 80 or 90% of the adult population, and many, many of the children are even thinking that today. So what do you do with that? And I think one of the things that you can do, if all you do is have an idea, is to show up. Show up. And when you show up, absolutely, don't just show up. You can, maybe on your first time, show up and take it in a little bit. Maybe the second time you show up, you're raising your hand and you're getting involved, but eventually you're going to show up and you might meet somebody that could change the trajectory of your career. You might meet your future business partner. You might meet somebody who ends up being your workplace soulmate. A light bulb may go off that gives you just a little bit more confidence to give it a shot, to go for it, because I think so many great ideas, they end up, as our buddy Chris Johnson says, in the graveyard, right? All these great ideas, they die along the way because people didn't show up. They didn't have the courage to make something happen. Just one baby step.
Exactly. I agree completely with you. The showing up is the key, and that's what we're doing here, is creating an opportunity, a place to show up. A place to show up with opportunities to come here and listen. Those of you that all came out today, God bless you. You guys are doing the great thing. You showed up to say, hey, what can I learn? How can I grow? What can we do? So showing up, learning, mixing, understanding, getting to know other people in the ecosystem is vital.
I want to backtrack to one thing, and then we can open it up to the audience, if you don't mind. One of the things, because we have early stage entrepreneurs, we have people who are idea stage, and maybe some that are, you know, 10, 20 employees. I know I've seen a few out there that have maybe 50, 60, a couple of companies. But those first steps in building what I'll call the inner circle or the winner circle, right? If you're going to build an inner circle, you're 13. It didn't start off with 13. How do you start in formulating that inner circle, the people who are going to be making the strategic decisions?
Well, that goes to my dad's thing, surround yourself with great people, right? So you got to find, now where do you do that? Like when I started, I mean, I'll be honest, the people that were part of my inner circle, most of them started as fraternity brothers that I knew. You know, because you got to have a personal connection, or you got to know somebody.
So you had the same core values,
right,
it sounded like,
right,
which was what? Drinking beer and
pretty
what was that?
Well, what it was I could pay them in a six-pack of beer. but it's connecting. But that's, like I said, I didn't have what you all have now. This ecosystem that exists in this town is huge. There are some amazing organizations, Startup Sac. You know, you go through the whole list of people that are here, Haney Viz, all you guys, that opportunity to mix and mingle and find that partner, like you said, by showing up is going to be great to get you that much further. But it is bringing the people in. The hard part is, who do you trust? Trust is a huge part, because you got to bring people in that you trust. You build that trust, but trust is a two-way street. They have to trust you too. So the
how
other
do you know? How do you know when you trust them? I mean, what indications are that person will take a bullet for me, and I would for him as well?
You know, it's a hard thing, because I've trusted people and been burnt by the trust. Right? We all have. I know you have, I know I have, and all of you have. So it's not a given, but it's something culturally you want to set up, is that trust. That this is we're a team member, and that trust is built, and it's built by you sharing with them and them sharing with you. It's like any relationship. You know, if it comes one-sided, to me it doesn't work. The other thing I just want, before we get off of this, that I want to say on the inner circle term, be careful of the inner circle term and concept, because culturally, for me, if you are an inner circle company, the rest of the employees look and say, "Oh, that's that group. That's that group. They don't belong with the rest of us." Our culture was built on we're all the same. As my wife tells me every day, you put your pants on one leg at a time like everyone else, so shut up and, you know, go out there. But, you know, you've got to, I believe the culture needs to be not white, ivory tower. I know you do too, because I know your culture. But a lot of companies you see, the culture is ivory towerism, where the inner circle, the only opinion that matters. To me, the best opinion is on the front line. I went out, you know, I shared with you, I went out 1 year, I went out, and I really wanted to hear what was going on. We had grown, and trying to keep culture scalable and grow as rapidly as we did is a challenge, but we did that. I went out, and I went to every district and every market, and I told the district leaders and the executives above them, you can't join the meeting. I just want to talk to the store managers and the warehouse managers and hear from them directly what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. Scared the crap out of my, executives. They go, "Well, how's that going to come back on me?" But in the end, everybody appreciated the insight that we got from the people on the front line. It's amazing.
The truth is in the trenches, and you know, if you're not out talking to the customers, if you're not in the front line, how are you going to really know to drive some of these strategic decisions? Thinking about this, though, you're the CEO of this company, and especially as you begin to scale, we all know that communicating the vision, talking about the purpose, the direction of the company, there's certain rhythms. You're a busy man, right? You're a busy man when you have 1,000 employees, and how am I going to get the message to the front line? You can't visit every one of them face-to-face every day. Is it monthly? Is it quarterly? How often do you get the entire group together? How do you reach that front line? Or is it, hey, I went out every so often and scared the crap out of them?
No, I believe you have to be out there constantly. And like, I believe, as we've talked before, it's about building your team. If your team's doing everything else, you have more time to go out there and do that aspect, to do that as CEO. If you've got good, solid people you can trust to run the company, your job is out to coordinate everybody else and make sure they're all on board. It's also about that team. Like when those roundtables that we have and the thing, everybody's on the same page. So we're all speaking out of the same playbook, and we're out there, and everybody is promoting the culture. Everybody on the executive team is out there constantly talking. And then when we did the ESOP, we had a culture committee. So from every area, we had people on the culture committee that were just frontline people that joined the committee, and then they built the culture and continue to say, this is what our values are, this is what our vision is, this is what our purpose is, and continue to promote who we were.
Mission, values, purpose, vision, philosophies, mantras, these words that we have that help remind us of what we're trying to accomplish. I'm wondering, from your standpoint, how did you simplify this? When you have 1,000-plus employees, how many thousands do you have?
1,600.
1,600. So you have these kind of simple concepts or maybe complex strategies that need to be given to the front line. I know today we were talking in our meeting, you had a triangle that helps make it easy for your advisory board to be able to sort of digest. How important are these symbols and mantras and so on, and how do you utilize those?
Well, the most important thing is it's got to be real. You know, it's got to be real. I mean, how many of you have worked in a company that says they have these things or the mission, value, and purpose, but they don't execute on that? They don't believe it. You sit there and go, yeah, they say that, but they don't do it. So you got to do the cult. You got to do what you believe in. So we built our mission, value, and purpose from the ground up. I didn't dictate it. Our executives didn't dictate it. We put them together, said, who are we? Who do you want this company to be? And we had them build it. That's number one step that I think is important. It needs to come from the ground up. It can't come from the top down. Nobody buys top down. You got to have buy-in, in my opinion. So you've got to have that. So you do it from the bottom up. Now, can you gently ease over here or smooth out this or correct that just to make sure it's in line with everything else you're trying to do? Yes. But, you know, you got to do that. You know, so many of the mantras and how many cultural things you go to don't work. We did quite a few cultural things that didn't work. You know, we did it for a short period, then we stopped.
What didn't work?
Which I don't want to throw any cultural leader under the bus, but you know, there's programs.
No,
we're going
to
do this. We're
going to
do this. Well, we did, you know, one which everybody gives me a hard time about in the company was our Happy Camps. Where we brought, this is actually our first cultural change where we brought in a consultant. I didn't call it Happy Camp. That was their nickname for it because they were supposed to be happy. And they came to the thing where they were teaching about, you know, let's build this. And we built our mission that it worked in the end. But going through it was painful for everyone. And then there were parts of it that didn't work. And we would go along this stage of, you know, having these kind of meetings. And everybody hated these meetings. And they were non-productive. So we finally got rid of that. You got to always check everything. Is it working? Is it not working?
One of the things, I'm just recalling going to a concert at one of your various pavilions. I think it was the one out in Marysville. And it was named Sleep Train. And you guys were having a party out there, and I tried to sneak in. I never told you this before, but I tried to sneak in because it looked like it was a fun place to go. And I'm like, I could sneak my way into this thing. I was denied, but it stuck out to me the unity of the team denying me. This is Sleep Train culture, dude. Get the heck out. And so, I mean, you guys threw parties. I mean, what was it that worked?
Well, our culture was, our number one value was integrity. That was my number one value. That had to be the company's number one value is integrity. One of our other values was celebration. I believe firmly in celebrating your successes and bringing people together. We celebrated a lot. I mean, in the early days, you don't have any money.
Oh, how do you celebrate when you don't have any money? What do you do?
Beer and pizza is cheap.
Okay.
Beer and pizza is cheap.
You got to eat anyway,
you know,
right?
You got to eat. Everybody's got to eat. You can, you know, it's amazing what you can do with beer and pizza. And it's amazing what you learn about your company when you're having beer and pizza with your employees. And they're sitting there and they're going, I mean, I constantly would have people say, you're the CEO. Why are you having pizza with us? I like pizza. I like beer. You know, why wouldn't I join you? You know, and sitting talking to them and having them share with you what's going on. So that culture of celebration was also a means of us extracting true feelings from our employees, what they thought. Our President's Club was infamous. Our President's Club was a week in Maui. Week in Maui, full paid, everything was paid, dinners, you know, cruise ship out to watch the whales, you know, the luau, everything was there for a week with your spouse. Our executives weren't allowed to bring their spouses. The reason is I wanted our executives to be of service to our sales and marketing and operation and everybody. That's the other thing. Everybody was included in the President's Club. It wasn't just a sales contest. To me, as I told our sales team all the time, you could sell all you want, but if that warehouse guy doesn't take it into the warehouse and that delivery guy doesn't deliver it and the customer service person doesn't handle any problems and the accounting person doesn't pay the bill, it doesn't work. Everybody in a company counts. And so we made sure that our President's Club and all our celebration included everybody. And so we would take them there and do that. And, you know, now my executives' wives and husbands were not happy with my choice there. But it was the right thing to do because then you have one client. Our employees were who we were supposed to take care of.
What about open door policy? You've got 1,600 employees, so I had a max was 300. Now I'm more of an investor. I've got maybe with my operating companies maybe 100 or so, but there's an open door policy. But it was a smaller number. With 1,600 people, you've had that much success. Did you find a way to know all your employees, and did they have the open door to come talk to Dale Carlson?
Absolutely, absolutely. I believe did I know them all? No. I mean, I knew. Generally, someone would tell them their name and where they're at. I generally knew where they were and what they were doing, but you just can't. At one point, I lost that. I used to know everybody's name.
How long could you hold? Up to what point? What number? Like, I forget it.
Yeah, I can't tell you. Yeah. But it's there was when I got to that stage, and I'll tell this is an inside secret, and sorry to the employees out there that might hear this, but I would always have somebody with me that would whisper in my ear. You know, that's James Gardner. James runs the biggest sales store we have in Southern California. He's done this, this, and this. His wife's name is Betty, and they have three kids. James, how are the kids doing? What are they doing? You know?
It's no different than going to the dentist, and they're asking you about your kids, yeah. And you're like, right. How do you remember that, right? They got the notes.
They got the notes.
Yeah.
But what it means to us as human beings to be recognized, and then when I walked away, I knew James, and I knew his kids. So it sunk more into my head of who he was.
Like that intimacy you're Right. You're intimate quicker with somebody if you've got just that little background.
And just knowing how important it is as a leader anywhere, in any company you're in, to be a leader, to be upfront and to be real with your employees and let them see your vulnerability. You know, so many of us try to be tough, strong, and that. When they see you're vulnerable, they understand that you're a human being, and it breaks down the barriers.
So I want to get back to Sac State for a second here. We're at Sac State, the culture of Sac State. We're known as a government countdown here in Sacramento. Sac State is the anchor university for your cause of entrepreneurship and innovation. I mean, how do you expect the culture to change here at the university? We talked about the broader region at some level, but how can a university change? Can it transform from, 100 people a year kind of figuring out entrepreneurship to, what do we have, 16,000? How many people are in Sac State?
31,000 Yeah. No, the culture is changing already. We've already seen just in the last year what it's changed, and it's growing dramatically. You also have a commitment by, the president, President Nelson, and everybody here to bring entrepreneurship to the region and to the students, because quite frankly, basic education the way it was when I went to school won't get you through life in the future right now. You need to think innovatively. You need to understand what innovative thought process and creativity is. You need to understand how entrepreneurship works and how you can actually be part of that, either as an entrepreneurial, working from within a company or on the outside. All that needs to be done. So he wants to change the world here. And the other thing we're doing is that this isn't just a Sac State program. We have actually brought together UC Davis, Sac State, Sierra College, Los Rios Community College, Consumus College, William Jessup, UOP, all coming together to say, as a region, how do we make education accessible, entrepreneurial and innovation education accessible to everyone. So we're trying to connect everybody together, not just Sac State students. So when you take that and you extrapolate what that does to our region, if you could take the students in all those campuses and give them the tools to succeed and open companies and drive innovation and change both in public and private world, look what an impact we can have.
The impact that we can have for this generation, but what about the ripple effect of a success story like what you've had? How many generations does that hit? The people made millions who were employed within your company, and you changed the lives of so many, and the ripple effect that's happening for beyond our generation.
Absolutely, and that's the greatest part, is that ripple effect is huge because it continues to grow. And what you find is all these people, as they exit and have great successes, they want to give back. So they're giving back, creating even more, and that it just grows and grows and grows.
Okay, so final thought around building a great team, building a great culture. If you could give the next Dale Carlson is sitting in our audience. He's just coming out of his fraternity. He's trying to decide what he's going to do, but he knows he's got something, and he's got the idea. You got to build a great team. We got that. What else? What's next for the next Dale Carlson?
I tell him not to wear Angel Flight pants. You have to be old to get that.
Yes.
To me, the best advice I give is, one, to surround yourself with great people. Treat them right. Make everybody successful. To me, that's what drove me constantly. We always came back to check that. Are we doing this? That's building the team. Building the team and understanding your limitations. Getting out of the way. So, you run into them, I run into them, the entrepreneurs we talk to, they're in their own way. If they would just realize that if they had the right team players, their project, whatever it is, would skyrocket. But they're in their own way because they think they have to control it. So the biggest advice is learning how to let go and trust someone else to run with it, but be cautious at the same time to not give it all away and so forth. I think that's an important thing is that I learned, if I look back at my history, we would have been so much further ahead and done so much greater good if I had learned that early enough to let go, to delegate, and to trust someone else to take on something that's better than me.
Let go, trust, bring on people that are better than you, And show up, my friend. Show up like you did today. I'm going to open it up for questions from the audience. Anybody out here who wants to ask Dale Carlson a question?
Or Mark.
He's never been asked before. I challenged this guy in the front row at the beginning. We want to ask, stump Dale Carlson. I don't think you can do it.
Oh, I can't. What were the five biggest mistakes? What were the biggest mistakes that you would made that you wouldn't do again?
I probably won't go through five because that's a long litany of, number one, acknowledge you make mistakes. That's a good thing. But my biggest one was not sticking with what I know. So we were going along, doing pretty good, and I was buying 70% of these comforters from a woman that had a shop up in Tahoe City. So day beds were all the rage. That's the bed that, it's a couch and a bed. They're all the rage. We were buying 70% of her product. She wanted to sell it. I go, we're 70%. I can clearly sell the other 30%. That'd be easy, right? I'm a salesman. I'm great at that. We can do this. Bought the company. Problem is, I didn't know how to make a quilt. I didn't know the concept of what she was doing. I didn't understand that fabric colors and patterns change rapidly in fashion. That what is the in color today in 3 months is horrified by most people that they think it's just horrible color. So I learned that, and that cost me what I used to call my Harvard education, because I could have gone to Harvard for what I learned, my lessons that I did, but it was a fortune to learn that lesson, that stick with what you know and you're good at.
I'm gonna bounce over here to ask a question that I wasn't expecting to ask, but it just came to me. There's a guy named Rush Limbaugh that within the last couple of days was diagnosed with lung cancer. I don't know if everybody's heard of Rush Limbaugh before. Who is Rush Limbaugh to you in the sleep train?
Rush got me going, quite frankly. When I first started, if you haven't heard the story, when I first started, I had no money. Couldn't advertise. Didn't have any way to do it. I was advertising the Penny Saver, that throwaway newspaper. And I had an account executive for KFBK who came in and said, hey, I want you to buy radio. And I said, I can't afford radio. He said, well, I got this new guy on the station. He needs a bed. Will you at least take care of him? I go, sure. I'll take care of anybody. Bring him in. Brought him in, helped me, Rush Limbaugh. Russ had just started in Sacramento. He'd been fired from three other companies before that. It was just starting to get going. And he had determined that the way for him to have long-term success was to have the station dependent on me, on him, versus him being dependent on the station. So by getting me to have him endorse my product and my company, that would be his success story. So he went on the air, and I don't know how, I still to this day don't know how we did this, because I didn't have the money to pay the bill, but he went on the air and started telling my story. People came in left and right saying, I want the bed Rush sleeps on. Well, I had no money at that time, as I said, and Rush had no money at that time, because he had just started. So Rush had just bought a middle-line bed. I called him back up and said, Rush, they will buy any bed you're sleeping on. I am going to give you the top-of-the-line bed so that when they come in and say they want the bed you sleep on, it's this one, not this one. So we started that. Then I learned that, now Rush's show, by the way, those of you that look at him and what his show is now, Rush's show was not that way when we started. It was, it was a way different show than it is today. But we realized he couldn't be the only one to do that. So we tried the afternoon team. They worked. Then we tried the morning team on one of the radio stations, and that worked. And since then, I've used hundreds of personalities. And the greatest part about the product I sold, everybody needed it. It didn't matter what their politics was. It didn't matter what their religion was. It didn't matter what their ethnicity was. It didn't matter. None of those other statistics matter. All that mattered was a good night's sleep. So we were able to use, all the whole spectrum to make that work. So he really, and he told me when he left that he, the people you meet on the way up are the same people you meet on the way down and always take care of you. So to his credit, when he moved to New York, he continued to do spots for me at the rates he did in Sacramento, and continued to do them until a while back ago, where we parted ways from that. So.
It's interesting to think about the people that come into your life that are game changers. We talked about there may be a game changer here in the room tonight for somebody in this room. What would you say to Rush today?
Well, I'd absolutely say thank you. I've told him over and over again. I mean, he he shared with me what it was. And I was saying, you know, the Rush that you all know or hear here is not the Rush that's in person. He is a very humble, quiet man generally, or he was. I think he still is. I haven't talked to him in a little while, but he was. I mean, I feel my heart goes out to him and his family. I went to their wedding. It was a wonderful wedding. Catherine and his wife is a wonderful human being. So it was, he's a good person in that way, and that he got me started. He helped me out. He got me to understand marketing in a different way.
Other questions? Audience. Yes. Oh, yeah, right here, James. Could you say your name, too, and where your company is?
Oh, I'm James Gardner. We have Acton Academy, which is a new school that we're starting in El Dorado. My question for you is, and I like to ask this of everyone, is what's your why? Why did you do it? Besides a good night's sleep, but why?
Why? Because I saw an opportunity. Quite frankly, and that's, to me, that's all entrepreneurship is. You see an opportunity. For me, I was, you know, I had a part-time job at a mattress manufacturing company, became a sales manager, and going out and seeing how mattresses were sold, I thought it was being done wrong. I thought there was a better way to sell mattresses. I thought in those days, mattresses, you'd buy a mattress, they'd deliver it in 6 to 8 weeks. You need a bed that night. That's why you went out to buy a bed. You don't need it in 6 to 8 weeks. So I go, that's crazy. I want to deliver it that day. Same day delivery. Here you go. Now, as I've told the story before, my same day delivery consisted at the beginning because I had no money. Here's the keys to my truck. You can take it home. Just bring my truck back. My insurance company and lawyer said that wasn't a good idea, by the way. So, but that the why was I saw an opportunity. I mean, I didn't grow up as a 6-year-old and say, I want to be a mattress guy. You know, I just saw that there was an opportunity to do something better. And then as I grew, it was an opportunity. How do I make, you know, I wanted, my goal was 10 stores. I wanted 10 stores. That's all I wanted. I wanted to make $1,000 a month at each store, make $120,000 a year. I thought that would be fantastic. The reason we had 312 stores when we sold in 6 states was because I had great people that wanted more for themselves. How do you take someone that's a salesman that wants to be a store manager when you don't have another store to put them in? But that's a great person that would do that. How do you take a store leader that would be a great district leader if you don't have another district? How do you take a regional leader and create another spot unless you have another region? So we had to keep opening stores because I had too many great people. I was very blessed. So.
Yeah, right there in the middle.
Dominic Salamone with Traditions Law. Dale, was there any opportunity that you had to pass by because the people weren't the right people? And, you know, why was the reasoning for you passing the opportunity?
Employees, companies, or vendors?
Just any business venture, whether that be with Sleep Train or subsequently after?
Yes. I mean, to me, if you have values, everybody has to abide by your values. So, you know, integrity is my number one value. And when we would come across a vendor or an employee or a company we were looking to buy that didn't have integrity, we wouldn't do that. You know, it's integrity is everything to me. And if that is truly your value, then everybody around you has to have integrity. Otherwise, you just get brought down. We were talking earlier about how, you know, doing the right thing means doing it even when it costs you. You know, we had, you know, one of the hardest lessons on values that you said was top sales writer for the company. Top sales writer. Million plus a year, million and a half a year, I think the person was doing, but had integrity issues on how they were getting there. Literally was selling product that we had an internal price that we wanted them to sell for, sold it for a higher price. Great, we made more money, but that's not who we are. We don't do that. And so I had to fire that person. Where'd that person go? But across the street to my competitor. So not only did I lose all the volume of their sales, they're also at my competitor selling more over there. But what it did was it told everybody in the company that integrity is our number one value and that I am not going to sell out on integrity just for money. So it's important to do that, and that's what I would base all our relationships on. Did they have integrity? Yeah.
Another question? Oh,
Dale, I'd love to hear more about your exit story and what you're doing now.
Sure. So my exit was, you know, fantastic for me. no, my exit, though, people ask why. The why did I exit? I had a great company. I had great employees. I loved everything I was doing. But quite frankly, the industry was changing. We constantly, in these retreats and everything like that, we'd look at what's happening way out here. Because we wanted to, our goal was, what is the company we want to be? And what's the company that, if it existed today, would put us out of business? And let's become that company today. Well, as we started looking at that, we started looking at who was going to put us out of business and going, could we be that company? You know, when I got into the business, part of the reason I got into the business was neither the big boxes or the internet could really do it because it's a touch and feel product. So I thought, until Casper came out and decided to say, no, it's not. Will you buy it from online? Because now everybody's used to buying on Amazon. The ability to sell mattresses online skyrocketed. That was going to change. The manufacturers had consolidation had taken over in the manufacturing world. I used to have Serta, Simmons, Sealy, and Tempur-Pedic as four different vendors that I could play off of each other and negotiate with. Well, Tempur-Pedic bought Sealy, and Simmons bought Serta. Now I only had two. That was changing my negotiation ability. The world was changing in a lot of ways, and we had worked hard through the recession. Could we gear up again to fight the new round, or should we look at the opportunity to exit because my employees own 25% of the company? They would not get their money if I just held out because it was what I wanted to do. I needed to monetize their investment and their hard work by maximizing through the strategic sale we did with Mattress Firm. On top of that, I wanted to grow the Ticket of Dream Foundation for foster kids, and I wanted to take our program nationwide, and Mattress Firm agreed to do that. And so we grew the program nationwide. We now at Ticket of Dream, we service all 50 states, and we service about 165,000 of the 425,000 foster youth out there by providing services, funding, and items and laptops and training and so forth for them that we get to do. So that's what I get to do. I left Mattress Firm when I left. I was president of the company when we sold. President of Mattress Firm after we sold. Did that for a year. Decided my heart was taking care of kids and helping others. So I decided to do that. And so I'm CEO of Ticket of Dream and get to do that. But then I looked and said, what else am I going to do when I grow up? What am I going to do now? Because, you know, I still like doing things. And so I looked and said, what other things are my interests? Entrepreneurship was one of the top interests that I had. Charity and philanthropy is a big interest. Entrepreneurship. How can I do something to change the world in that world? And so we looked and talking with Robert Nelson, the president here, decided this was the way we could do it. We could have an impact on our region, which I so dearly love and has benefited me by creating the Entrepreneurship Center here, working with different entrepreneurs and being able to give consulting and which I don't do a lot. Don't call me for that because I don't have any time. But I'd like to give my consulting consists of, you know, tell me what you're doing and what you need, and I'll help you. That, you know. So, but hearing more of those things, I love it. I love hearing what people come up with and being part of what Mark does and the community and all that. And then my other one is I have investments. We've made a lot of money. I've got to manage the investments. I have a team that oversees that. So I still have a team, which is cool. And they kind of help me with our investments. And we're invested in a lot of different things. It's kind of fun to get invested in things that weren't my company before everything went into the company. Everything. I didn't have anything outside of the company. So the ability to do that. And my last one, which you know well, is fun. I had the four buckets. My wife says I'm oversubscribed on my fun bucket. She says, you're just doing a little too much over here. Maybe you need more here. But I get to have fun. I get to play golf finally and actually enjoy golf because I'm not worried about what I should be doing. I get to enjoy golf. My golf sucks, though. I got to work on that. Where are we going?
Pick one out, Monique. Oh, sorry. We'll catch him next.
Yep. All right. Hi, I'm Luciana Radimski from KEI Partners. I have a twofold question. We're blessed to live in a country where taking risks and failure is a badge of honor. In your opinion, when to say when? You talked about losing money in your first store, and you kept persisting on. Secondly, and this is for both Mark and Dale, Where do you think opportunities lie? And not so much in the buckets, but what are you not seeing cross your desk that you'd like to see that maybe some of these entrepreneurs should be pursuing or thinking about, or they already have the idea and saying, ah, someone believes there's a true opportunity?
Interesting. I forgot the first one already.
The first one was about failure.
Oh, failure. When to say when. Good question. A lot of people said I should have said when a lot earlier, but as long as you still have the guts, you still have the strength, and somehow you can finance it, if you truly believe in it, it's that grit, it's that tenacity, it's that just power through it that all entrepreneurs actually do to get their first success. It's what it takes to get there. So to me, it's when you can't do it anymore. And that bucket goes the impact you're having on others around you, you know, your family, what they're having to go through. It can't be all about what you're going to do. It's got to be that. It's also listen to advisors, you know, to some degree. Don't live your life through an advisor's input, but open your ears and say what they're really telling you need to do and how you need to change. That's a key thing there. The second one, as far as I'm going to turn to you.
What are we looking for? So I'm invested into my investment focus is relentlessly local. I'm invested into close to 40 companies here in the region at some level. And I won't speak to something that I know I'm missing because I invest into what I'll call Main Street type companies as well as what I call my rocket ship portfolio, the ones that are scaling very fast, or that's the plan anyway. So I'm looking for both, but my focus is relentlessly local. So I love the idea of partnering with people who are very forward-leaning, who have a little bit of revenue that need a little there, but might be missing a business partner or two, not just the money, but might be missing a couple of advisors. One investment that I invested into, a guy that we both know, Trifecta Nutrition. So he's the fastest growing organic food delivery company in the U.S. And I met Greg and I fell in love. He's a rock star. His sister's the co-founder. And Mark, you want to invest? Sure. And I introduce him to my good buddy Uriah Faber, our good buddy Tom Kandris, who is also my next door neighbor, who is also a packaging guru. And so he started putting some strategic people in his life, a little bit of my help, a little bit of my money, and the business has skyrocketed a little bit because of me. So I get to live. I'm looking for people who I can live vicariously through their success. So I feel like a little part of Greg's success. So I'm looking for that person out there that wants to let me live a little vicariously through your success along the way.
Absolutely. No, that's the greatest joy we get is being able to live that success through other people and letting them enjoy that and seeing them do that. You kind of summed up a lot of what I believe in too. The key thing too, if you're out there and you have an idea, once again, find out what you're missing. And when you're looking for an investor, find out not beyond their money, is there something else they can bring? I mean, you brought Uriah Faber to the table. I mean, that is something that the investors have other things besides just capital for you. So be looking out for that. What can they help you with? What skill set do they have to help you as well versus money? So they're strict capital investors, and there's other ones that can help you with the project. But you got to be willing to listen.
Two more right there in the white shirt.
Yes, Kent Meyer, Traditions Law, and I'm a new mentor in the Sierra College
awesome.
Entrepreneurship program. And it seems really exciting, the fact that you have these individual pieces that are now starting to come together. Is it, you know, what do you see as the future of this? Do you see it as a consortium where we can interchange ideas, where maybe even set a group on the internet, which is our own group, where we're talking to each of the entrepreneur sponsors and mentors in each other and being able to, you know, capitalize on our mutual experience? We do international and domestic law. So the part that I'll be working on advising is in that area for entrepreneurs. Right. Seems like a lot of times that marketing is exciting, social network really exciting. The law isn't so exciting. And a lot of times entrepreneurs really don't have the fundamentals they need to grow in that area and protect themselves and their technologies and their ideas. So I think it's great what you're doing. I was a emeritus professor here at Cal State.
Oh, fantastic.
In the School of Business as well, and also a professor at McGeorge. And I mean, the idea UOP and CSUS and the other universities joining together is a fabulous idea.
Well, thank you. Yes, dream is collaboration. I mean, bringing everybody together. There's only the one thing we have is we have limited resources in town. So when they're pulled apart so much, it doesn't work. But if we can work together, those resources are larger, right? So collaboration is what my dream is. How do we bring that collaboration together? How do we share knowledge? You know, how do we, especially with technology now, you know, why if we have this going on right here, it should be, it can be streamed at all the colleges across the region so everybody can see it and do it. It doesn't have to be proprietary anymore. Let's break down the silos that are out there and say, if we work together, because anything, if you're an entrepreneur, you know, collaboration is the only way you succeed. You don't succeed without that, because as Mark says, no single person created any business. They collaborated with others to do that. So it's great. One thing, I'll back you on the law. One of the other pieces of advice my dad gave me is that you need three things that are important, and I'm going to forget them all. You need a good lawyer, you need a good accountant, and you need a good insurance person. Because if you don't protect yourself in these categories, all your hard work can go down in a minute. So we had lawyers within our company. We hired lawyers to work within the company because we did everything through that. And it saved us so much money. The money seems hard when they charge so much money. No offense. No, but it's hard to pay that. But all you need is one time to understand it's worth it.
And especially when you're setting up a company or early stage company, the decisions you make at the beginning, who your founding team is, what kind of company you set up, these things are critical, especially as you go out to get investors. This guy's been waiting for a question right here.
Well, my name is Tella Suds. I'm actually one of the foster kids that benefited from.
Oh, God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you. My question would be, I'm working on building a marketing company. How do you get past the fear of not knowing what to do all the time?
You fake it. It's funny you say it. I will tell you this. For decades, probably, my biggest fear was someone's going to figure out I don't know what I'm doing. And that's decades of success, you know, early days not, but and still probably when I sold it, it's like, well, they didn't figure out I don't know anything. So it's common. So just know that. Understand that that is normal. And just believe in yourself. Believe in what you are. It's the passion that will get you through. Believe in what you're doing. You know you're doing the right thing. And if you surround yourself with the right people, you'll make it work. It's about, and if you're smart enough to surround yourself with people that will take care of you and take care of the areas where you have blind spots, then you're going to succeed. So that's the only thing you need to know is find the right people. The other stuff comes to you. You just kind of make decisions because of what your core values are. Any other?
I couldn't agree more. I like to say, put the people in your life that make you feel just a little bit less afraid. Because we all have doubts. We all have fears. We all have uncertainties. Don't kid yourself. You might be overcoming them today. Tomorrow, they'll be back, right? It happens. That's 56 years old. How old are you?
58.
58. Okay, we still have it. We put people in our life. How long have you been married?
29 years.
Okay, I got you beat there. 34 years. So you do that in every area of your life, and it makes going through it so much less fearful, man.
Absolutely. One more back there?
Yeah, one more. Last one.
You said three things. You need. You also need a good realtor.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm a realtor.
Absolutely. 100%.
My name is Dan Gossett. I'm obviously a realtor. Going back to one of the questions that you asked, or that Mark was asking you earlier, you were talking about that kind of inflection point going from, you have employees that are really good, the accountant that's really good, you know, under a million, but then you grow. Can you talk us through like a conversation you had or how you kind of had that, you know, I'm not at that level where I'm making that decision, but I've seen that happen in companies that I've been a part of. And it's always painful for the owner to go through that process. Do you have any tips and advice for that?
Well, first tip I'd say is, you should be seeing that early enough to give them an opportunity to scale. So if you can call it out, say, hey, you're going to need to understand, learn a little more. You need to learn more in this area. You need to go out and get more knowledge in this area. And then it's up to them to see if they want to scale. But if you have those conversations and you're providing them the opportunity to succeed, that was always our bottom line. When you anybody that was terminated at our company, they knew it was coming because I told my team, did they have the opportunity to succeed? Did they have the tools to succeed? Did they have the training to succeed? If they had all three of those and they didn't succeed, then you could terminate them. So as long, but it took time because you had to make sure they were given the tools, they're given the opportunity, and they're given the training to do it. So you got to walk them through that, and then the conversation is much easier, because then we've talked about this. I'm sorry, but this is not working, and it's hard because for when I've had to do it, it's been some people that have been with me a long time, and have been trusted partners, but it's just not their role. Now, many of them, I shouldn't say many of them, several of them, I will say, have come back later and said, thank you, because I was over my skis and I was in fear every day and I was not enjoying myself. My new job is actually more rewarding for me. So don't misunderstand or don't miscalculate that they may not want that to happen as well. They don't want to be perceived as a failure there, so you can help them make that exit that way. And as far as real estate, just to underscore your real estate thing, my dad, another advice from my dad was, you know, your marketing budget and your real estate location are the same bucket. So where you are and how you're visible is in that same bucket. So it's vital to have the right real estate. My first real estate, you know, once again, knowing everything, you know, when you start out, you know everything. I didn't have a real estate person. It was me. Where's the real estate location I chose? But on Watt and Howe, on Folsom Boulevard, between Watt and Howe next to Roma's Pizza, that is not a great retail location. No one knows where it is. It wasn't until we did How About Arden and went from there that decided, look what happens to sales. We literally have moved a store one block on a street and doubled the sales. So real estate is critical of doing the right real estate deal.
I want to thank everybody for coming, and there was a question earlier about what do you imagine for the future, and I feel like it's beginning to happen. If you imagine a city where the business leaders unite, where every entrepreneur in the town has each other's back, and as the leaders in the community rally to help the best of the up-and-comers, we can ignite an entrepreneurial revolution right here in this hometown we love. And it's happening at Sac State University. It's happening at the Carlson Center. It's happening because of Dale Carlson. And it's happening because of Cameron Law. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.